Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I sit down with fascinating people to explore their passions, pursuits, and points of view. So what's it all about, Alfie? Well, if we're being honest, most of us don't know what it's all about, but my guest just might, Laura Munson. She's a best-selling author, founder of the acclaimed Haven Writing Retreats, and she joins me to talk about her new book, The Wild Why, Stories and Teachings to Uncover Your Wonder. And it's available everywhere books are sold. It's an invitation to rediscover something we all share but often overlook, wonder. As Laura explains, wonder is that mix of curiosity and awe even the most hardened cynic feels when a rainbow appears. And because it's universal, wonder has the power to connect us and deepen empathy. And you can learn more about Laura at Laura Munson. That's M-U-N-S-O-N, lauramunson.com. Follow her on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and X. And Laura, I'm sorry, with that big introduction, we're out of time. No, we're not. Welcome to the show.
I knew I would love you, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I won't ask you why the sky is blue, but I will challenge you on one thing in your book, which you talk about. You say everyone's creative, but I've met several people in my life, which is, you know, I'm relatively young. I'm in my early 20s. But the point is, I've met a lot of people who don't appear to me to be creative. So how are you able to, and I'm delighted with the book, by the way, and I think people should read it, but how do you get to those people who I perceive as not necessarily being creative? And I can't explain why they're not creative. They just don't seem to have a thought or a wonder about them.
This is my favorite subject. Thank you so much for going there straight out of the chute. So here's the deal. I am not a wonderologist. I do not have letters after my name in the science of wonder. But what I have worked at since 1988, when I realized I was a writer and have written book after book after book, some of them are good, three are published, but I also need, I've got about 8 good ones, but about 20 that are just sitting there and never will see the light of day.
That's okay. You did the work. That's important.
That's right. It's always working in you. It's not about the result. It has to be about the love of it, the hunger of it. So back to your question, I think that what happens, because I've worked with so many people at my Haven Writing Retreats in Montana, over 1,000 now, and I'm also a speaker, so I've spoken in front of thousands of people, and I hear the same exact thing, which is a refusal, which is what I'm hearing from you. Not everybody's creative. And many people say, I'm not creative.
Well, hang on, just wait. Let me challenge you. I didn't say I'm refusing to accept it. I'm just asking that question because I've bumped into people, I've met people, I've worked with people that are not, in my opinion, not creative. I'm not refusing your concept. I'm just asking you how I can make them creative.
It's their refusal. I'm glad we got clear.
Oh, okay.
It's their refusal. So I think it's a myth. I'm not creative myth. I don't have a voice myth. I think that with traditional education, at least in the United States, when we're children, we get slotted. You're a brain, meaning you're academic. You're artsy, meaning you're creative. You're a jock, meaning you're athletic.
Yeah.
But that is a grand disservice, because everything we think, every action, everything that comes out of our mouth, never mind the way we dress or arrange our living room, is an act of creation. It can't be any other way. We are creative creatures. And when we're little wobbly kids, we're not sitting around thinking, I don't have a voice. I'm not creative. I'm stuck. I'm this, I'm that. Instead, we embrace our creativity. And to me, the most important question we can ask in our lives, no matter what we do, what we love, how we are, how we show up, who shows up for us, is what can I create? And that doesn't mean a painting or a book or a song. It means anything. It all begins in your mind. And so much of this book is about getting in touch with what we knew by birthright as children. And we knew we had creative spirits. It's just that we've lost it along the way.
Aren't those of us who are creative, and I'm casting a wide net, aren't some of us, so it's not, I'm not talking about myself, but those of us who are creative, or those of people who are creative, isn't there a percentage of them that are what I would call subconsciously creative? What I mean by that is this. Your book is designed in a certain way, and I think it's great. But there are people that are subconsciously creative in the choices that they make. So they are creating. They're just not consciously aware that they're creating. Is part of the goal of the book is to let those people know, hey, you can go beyond that and be even more creative. You don't realize you're already creating.
That's it. So that's what the subtitle is, Stories and Teachings to Uncover Your Wonder. And I would, so can I tell you a little story?
Absolutely.
On this subject? Okay. So that's why this book is full of stories, because I know we live our life in stories, in scenes, not in bullet points and talking points and 10 easy steps and tips and tricks. Those might stick for a minute, but what really sticks is a story, because that's how we have empathy for one another. And that's how we can climb into each other's shoes. So I heard, on the speaking circuit, everything I mentioned before, I've heard over and over and over again, I'm not creative. And I thought, that word is scary. So let's change it. So I was walking around in Montana, where I've lived for 30 years. I'm originally from Chicago, and I've lived in New York and all over the place. But I have chosen to be in the woods of Montana near Glacier National Park for 30 years. And as one does when one lives here, one wanders around in the woods. And we've got lots of stumps. And I love to sit on stumps because they're not usually like right on the trail. So it means that I've gone off trail and I'm just kind of playing around in my wonder. And I sat on this huge, beautiful stump. And I thought, what's behind the word creativity? Because that's what people are getting. This is a bad pun. And I didn't mean to do it. Snagged on, you know, a tree snag. Anyway, sorry. But people are getting snagged on this word creativity, this huge word. And they probably have been all their lives. Maybe they had a teacher who, you know, teacher, read my poem. Oh, I'm sorry. You're not a poet. You should go run around on the track field, you know, or just one comment like that can last a lifetime and engrave itself in our psyche and our hearts and tell us all sorts of nonsense about the fact that we're not creative. So I thought, what's behind creativity? Let's deconstruct mm-hmm. creativity. And I thought, well, I think it's wonder. And then I thought, well, wonder has me sitting on this stump, but that's a big word too. Especially for people who haven't habituated ideas that are considered creative. So I thought, well, then what's underneath wonder? And that's when it occurred to me, curiosity, but more than curiosity, because curiosity can too easily lead to what the rainbow reference. Oh, look at the rainbow. What makes a rainbow, Google? And now you're looking at your phone and not looking at the rainbow, which is only like a 4-minute phenomena or less. So I thought, well, creativity, but what about awe? And that's where it landed for me, that I think our civilization, at least in this culture, is very heavy on curiosity, but it stops there. And we need to bring it into our not knowing, our beholding. That's where I have found almost everything that matters to me, but you have to make room for it. And this book makes a case for this, and then how to make room for it.
That almost sounds like a spiritual component too. The awe. In other words, you're looking at the wider world, whether it's nature, the stump, as you said out there, or the ticks that bite you or get into your skin and get in your skin. I mean, that's part of nature too. So you have the negative part, right? Or curiosity killed the cat. So you have that side of the equation as well.
I also believe we are nature. I don't believe that even if we're in a Midtown Manhattan elevator, we are still nature. I don't believe that we go out in nature. So you're right. It's the tick. It's the mosquito. I just learned recently through wonder, I suppose, that mosquitoes are pollinators. So every time I kill a mosquito, I'm killing a potential pollination. So this presents a conundrum, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know it does. Now, do you have to eat Wonder Bread in order to have wonder?
Man in front of bagel. I think you could be curious about it. I think about
white bread and the non-nutritional aspects of it. Yes.
I just think it's more interesting to live in the wonder than trying to find the answers. The poet Maria Rainer Rilke, who I love, he wrote a beautiful book called Letters to a Young Poet. If you haven't read it or read it recently, get your hands on it. It's just a thin little book. It's advice from this wise man to a young poet. And in it, he says, love the questions themselves. Love the questions themselves. And that's really what I'm after in this book. I'm trying to get us back to the sandbox, Ira. When we were little wobbly kids, you remember it was just like, you didn't care if we, you know, what gender or where you're from or who your mom is. It was just like, you want to play? And before all the greed sets in that society teaches us, oh, your bucket is better than my bucket or my shovel's better than yours. It was just like, let's play. Let's build whatever we build and then let's connect it. Like, remember, like moats, like let's, so our dragons can be friends and maybe it'll hold water. And then that lives in us until it doesn't. And what I've learned in leading writing retreats and doing workshops and just being a human being on this planet is that in this worried world, and it is very worried, no matter what we believe spiritually, politically, et cetera, we can all agree it's a worried world, I think. And after going across the country, this country for 6 solid weeks, and then I went out again this summer, people were crying during these readings and coming up to me and saying, I had a 90-year-old woman who came up and said, I've been so depressed for so long, but I'm so sick of being called depressed. Mm-hmm. She said, when you were talking, I could flip it into, I've lost my wonder and I want it back. And that's the hunger with which I hope people will read my book. There's no 10 easy steps.
No, I like that. That's what I like about the book. When you were writing it, were you full of wonder the whole time? Or were there parts where, as any writer knows, writing a book, it can become a grind. But were you able to maintain your sense of wonder and awe while you were writing it?
What an excellent question. Any writer who would say, no, I never once had one moment of self-doubt or resentment toward the fact that, you know, the publishing world might not understand my book is lying, or they're delusional. Let's hope for the delusion and not the lie. Part of my job is to help people find the hunger behind their writing, because I can help them develop a book as a developmental editor. I've been doing it for years. I've helped lots of writers write books that have become published. Mm-hmm. That said, what I teach the most is that you're not going to show up for it unless you're hungry for it with a childlike spirit, even if you're writing about really difficult stuff. And only you can control that. You've got to control showing up, but that's good news, because that is the one thing you can control. You cannot control getting published. You cannot control what the critics have to say or what the readers feel when they read the book and what they have to say as a result. All you can control is doing the work. And to me, that's good news. So I remind myself, now having been a New York Times and an international and USA Today bestselling author of 2 other books, I know what it is to have critics. And so I know how to teach myself and my clients to get into that zone where the rest of the world goes away and you are in that place of creation and you are not thinking about the reader and you're not thinking about that one mean thing that somebody wrote from a big, huge publication about one of the books you wrote. And that's why you have to know why you write in the first place. And I write to shine a light on a dim or otherwise pitch black corner to provide relief for myself and others. And that relief comes from what? Living in this beautiful and heartbreaking thing called life for myself and others, which means I'm of service to self and others. And I have that on a piece of paper and have for years on my wall behind where I write, which is right here on a little bummer, little 3M post-it, nothing fancy. And it's when I wrote that I became very clear about what I write, despite what other people have to say. You have to show up for it because you have a hunger for it, which means it has to be sacred ground and only you can keep it that way.
You make an excellent point, because guests I've had on the show, they have different methods of writing and different scheduling and different approaches to writing. But there has to be an underlying hunger in order to do it, whether it's just writing a note on your phone and then getting to it later on, or picking a specific time of day, or whatever it is, that's underlying hunger. Now, here's my other excellent question. Once you've written the initial book, putting the critics aside, putting all that aside, you're focusing on your wonder, you're writing the book. Now, before it even gets to the publisher, you're putting on your editor's hat.
Yes.
And you're approaching this material that you've just created with a sense of wonder and enthusiasm and love of life. And you're starting to go through it. And now you're going to edit and you're going to rewrite in some cases. You're going to correct certain things. When you do that, do you get the same spark of creativity, or do you find it agonizing because of what you originally produced out of joy?
I love this question too. As a writing teacher and editor, I just led a retreat last week and I had a client that asked me the exact same question. So you're right. It is a good question. Here's the deal.
Well, I'm upset that somebody else asked it before I did, but okay, go ahead.
It's one of my favorite talking points. Per my point beforehand, we're all creative. It's just not possible that we're not. How do you think that we learn to walk? How do you think that we learn to, swallow when food is put into our mouths? I mean, everything we do is an act of creation. So So yes, of course, the act of writing is a creative act. And then the act of editing is a creative act. They're just very different muscles to flex. And what I tell people, and if they're writers out there, please, if you're just starting, the way I look at it is that there's the creative flow where the words come out. So think of a garden hose when the water's on, mm-hmm. and you just let the water flow out of the hose. And that's the creative writing part. Then, and I don't think it's something you do in the same session when you're beginning. Then you call that a day. Then you come back the next day, you read what you wrote with an editorial mind. That's when you kink the hose, you stop the flow of water or the flow of words, if you will.
But go ahead.
I've learned to love it, but I've got a point that I want to make after this. And that, so that this point is that then, yeah, you hold back on that, but that doesn't mean that you're abandoning it. It's just a kinked hose with water that wants to come out again. Maybe it's the next day, but you kink the hose or you turn the water off, whatever it is. You forget about like letting the words flow, and then you go in with your editorial hat. And the very best way to do that is to, the way I like to do it is if I have the time, and not everybody has the time, you make time however it works for you. But at the end of my writing day, then later on after dinner or whatever my responsibilities have been, like when I was a young mother, it was always late at night, I would read through, I would print it out and I would read through what I wrote. And that's when I would mark it up with a pen, with my editorial hat. Then the next morning, this is how Hemingway did it. Actually, I just read this not long ago. Then the next day you plug, so you're still in editorial mode. You plug in your edits. And so you've worn that editorial hat, and then you can unkink the hose and let it flow. And so you kind of tag team mm-hmm. the creative editor and the creative writer. Now, here's my word. It's a word to the wise. Don't try to do them both at the same time. Because that little pinky, especially if you're banging on a keyboard, can very easily push that delete button. And so now you're doing both. And it's something that is a very honed craft that takes years to know how to do. And I'll, as a quick example, one time, I forget what Matt, was it the New York Times? I think it was the New York Times. Said it was the Lives column in the New York Times magazine. They accepted an essay I wrote. And so I was working on the phone with the editor there. And I said, I bet you want me to get rid of this one paragraph, right? Like, that's too much. It's too tangential. And he said, no, that's the exact reason why I accepted this essay. So sometimes we don't know. We can have blind spots. And that's why it's really helpful to have the help of a good editor. Not everybody's a good editor.
True. So again, the name of the book is The Wild Why, Stories and Teachings to Uncover Your Wonder. And you have other books as well. I know there are two other, you mentioned two others that are.
Yes. My first published book is This Is Not the Story You Think It Is. It's a memoir, straight up in the lane of memoir. And that the short version of that book went really crazy viral. If I could do that again, I would, but I don't know how to. I wrote it in 1 hour, the essay version of it that appeared in the Modern Love column. And that's where I really got my career start. But fiction is my true love. But that book was published in 9 countries. A lot of people wanted the message, which was all about tuning into your thought patterns to see how they serve us and sabotage us, which is a lot about of what the Wild Why is about. And then that memoir became a New York Times bestseller, international. And then I got to get back to fiction. I never wanted to be the star of a book, the main character, but it was helpful, that service piece of mine in my author statement. That book, that memoir, This Is Not the Story You Think It Is, helped a lot of people. And then my second published book is Willa's Grove, and that is a novel. And if you love stories of people getting together and really sharing and talking and then experiencing the inner terrain of that and then the outer terrain of a place like Montana, well, then that's your book. And that was a USA Today bestseller. And then my agent is so happy with me because I keep changing lanes. So I now have put out a book in a third lane, which is self-help, but it's not like your typical self-help book, The Wild Why. And then next year I've got a book about writing, specifically about writing that comes out. And then after that, I've got 2 novels scheduled. So it's just going to be a lot of Laura Munson out there if you'll have me.
And in addition to all of that, you also have the retreat. So how is it? Are you that disciplined or am I just that undisciplined that I can't seem to get 2% of what you're putting out creatively?
Yeah, I don't recommend that you take on 3 full-time jobs. I don't know of an author, and even best-selling authors, that don't have some sort of side job. I'm really lucky to love mine. And you can learn about how it all began in The Wild Why, actually. It came out of post-divorce reinvention. So there's this beautiful element of reinvention in the book that is all about curiosity and all about awe, all about wonder, and putting your creative juices and prowess to task and to invite yourself into what's possible. What can I create instead of thinking, oh, I'm going to lose everything. And like, you see my body language just sort of withers, but it's like, okay, life just changed. Big plot twist. What can I create? Mm-hmm. And so I put on Facebook one day, and this was in 2012. Hey, anybody want to come on a writing retreat with me in Montana? Because mind you, just because you're best-selling author doesn't mean that you're rolling in the dough. That like under like 5% of the author, and like unless it's a household name, like a big one, very few writers are actually making money off of book sales. The money that you get if you're traditionally published is in the advance. And that's another story for another day. And it's a depressing one, the world of publishing, but there's light. But and so in 2 hours, 24 people signed up for this retreat that I'd never led, never designed, and didn't have a price point for nor a place to hold it. And I named it Haven Writing Retreats. And so when the doors open, people walk through them. When the door that you want to open and you're bashing your forehead, your face, your whole body bloody up against it, open door, if it just doesn't open, why not? Why not think about the world of possibility and look over your shoulder and maybe there's a beautiful open door with, you know, mountain bluebirds and a beautiful meadow with wildflowers. No, must open up the door that won't open. That does not serve you. And so suddenly just notice the plot twists in your life. Notice the invitations, have the courage to be playful with them. Even if it's really difficult stuff, no matter what's going on in your life, you can always find some playfulness. And that's something that I'm a big advocate for. So that's how I started Haven Writing Retreats. I've now worked with over 1,000 people from all over the world. I have a foundation, which is a 501c3 that allows me to give partial scholarships to those who are a perfect match for Haven and vice versa, mm-hmm. who could never afford it otherwise because it's expensive. It's an investment. It's probably the top writing retreat in the US and has been for a long time because it's rare to find somebody who leads a retreat who's also a best-selling author, understands the way it works to be a writer. And then if you want to move into the publishing aspect of it, understands that, and then also can be your editor and then create community. Because even though writing is done in solitude, it is born of living on this beautiful and heartbreaking planet.
And with other people.
With other people. The community piece is huge. And writers are often, people who are drawn to writing are often highly sensitive, full of empathy, and don't know how to manage it. And that's one of my main, like, I can teach you how to turn a phrase or twist a plot. But if you don't have your finger on the pulse of what you really have to say and what's behind it, it'll never build the bridge to the reader, because we have to use the writing to build the bridge to ourselves. And that's where we start to eradicate the tortured artist paradigm, because that's when we start to understand how important it is to be self-empathetic and to have filters and rules. Like I call it the inner colander. Like in Montana, I can have like no colander at all, or like the holes in it can be like huge. But when I go to New York City and I'm going to be there in a couple of weeks doing some book stuff, you know, I always just think of the colander as like dialing in the holes kind of small, because that's the tortured artist paradigm. People are so sensitive and full of empathy. You know, what makes you tick that they forego their own well-being and they take on too much and then they don't know what to do with it? I'm trying to change that.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point that there are so many, I'd like to meet more untortured artists. I think that would be very helpful. And where do you get your energy from?
I just, you know, I'm 59 last week And I just have always had a tremendous amount of energy. I don't know where it comes from because a lot of my life is pretty sedentary. Don't tell anybody, Ira.
I'm not saying anything.
No, don't tell anybody. I never write in my book. I mean, sorry, I never write my books in my bed either. Never. My commute has never been that I wake up, yawn, reach under my bed for my laptop, bring it up. As like a little exercise to see if I can use my core strength, open it up, grab a pillow, the flat one, that's my desk, and then start working. I've never done that before in my life. Listen, don't do that. It's so bad for your back. You got to move your body around. In my book about writing, I say, writing isn't just writing. It's living in a way that helps us find what we have to say. And so that can mean making soup or taking a walk. You have to believe it's always working in you, but you also have to be healthy to your body, kind to your body. And I need to remember these things.
The word of the day is posture. There you go. Now, before I let you go, I want you to let us know what you want people to take away from reading your book. Again, The Wild Why, Stories and Teachings to Uncover Your Wonder.
I want this book to be a friend. This is not a fast read. Willis Grove, people read in one sitting. This is not the story you think it is. The memoir, people are ripping through the pages to see what happens, which... That's not, they think it's a marital thriller, but it isn't and wasn't ever meant to be. But The Wild Why is meant to be a slow read, like a good friend that lives on your bedside table, that you mark up with pen, commit book graffiti to, journal in the pages, even if you want to, never give away. and it's beautiful because it came out April 8th. And so by now it's been really fun to see it's rippling. Like Maria Shriver in her Sunday paper, she chose it as one of her picks. Kelly Corrigan loves it. She has she's all about wonder and is a bestselling author and also a podcaster such as yourself. And there are just some really beautiful blurbs on it that are from people who understand how to live a more contemplative life. And this book calls you to that awareness and presence in your life without being specifically spiritual at all. And then at the end of each chapter, there is a call to action called Your Wild Why. And in those call to actions, I give you a way of like an invitation to how you want to maybe live for your life for a week. And some of it has to do with writing. Some of it has to do with thinking. Some of it has to do with how we relate with others. And you can love the book without doing any of those. But what most people are doing, I'm finding, is they're reading the whole book like a memoir, story forward, and then they're going back and doing the calls to action.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Laura Munson, author of The Wild Why, Stories and Teachings to Uncover Your Wonder. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and independent bookstores. And where else, Laura?
Well, online, you can go to bookshop.org, which is a wonderful way to online shop for books. And the profits go directly towards supporting independent bookstores. We need to support our independent bookstores, people.
Great. And for everything about Laura, go to Laura Munson, M-U-N-S-O-N, lauramunson.com. You can follow her on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and X. And Laura, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Ira. Thanks for having me and for all the good work you do in this world.
Thank you. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.